This episode of This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Axia Audio, makers of the IQ, the Element, and the new Radius console that was shown at NAB. Axia Audio, on the web at axiaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert. Well, Cyclone Wilma came through in February. It was a perfect lesson, and if there's a job to be done, don't let it wait too long.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Jack? All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
In Samoan, they call a white guy from the mainland a Palangi. This episode is called Palangi Joe.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome to This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack and I'm welcoming you into the show. This is the show where we talk about everything from the microphone and the stylus all the way through the audio console and up to the top of the tower. This is we talk about radio technology. And hey, that includes audio and RF technology and sometimes some allied technologies, including IP and IT infrastructure technology, more and more and more. So whether that RF is standard AM or FM or getting a digital signal out to people with mobile devices and cars and or even talking to submarines under the ocean, we talk about here on This Week in Radio Tech. Joining us on this episode, two of my favorite co-hosts. First of all, the Hudson Valley of New York brings us Tom Ray from WOR. Hi, Tom.
Speaking of submarines under the ocean, hey, good evening, Kirk. How you doing this evening?
I'm great.
VP Engineering at WOR Radio and Buckley Broadcasting in New York City, and I'm up here in the Hudson Valley about 50 miles north of New York City and 15 miles west of West Point, and I've resolved that sometime this summer I am going to see the West Point Army Band in concert.
All right. Well, you take a little camera out there and take a couple pictures for us. Or do a live remote. Hey, that could be cool. Tom, we missed you the last couple of weeks. I'm glad you're back with us. And we've got quite an interesting show with quite an interesting guest we'll get to in just a minute. Next, from Muckwanico, Wisconsin, let's bring in Chris Tarr, the Ninjaneer. Hi, Tom, Chris.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm great. Tell us about Chris Tarr.
I am the Geek Jedi. I'm the Director of Engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Madison and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I also run with a friend of mine, the engineering message board, broadcastengineering.info.
And a good place for engineers to go to find out what they need to know or just have a good argument.
We run the gamut. It's kind of like an SBE meeting on the internet.
Yeah, with less food and more drinking.
A lot more drinking, yes.
Hey, I got a ham radio question for Tom. Tom, is it okay to be on the ham radio, doing the ham radio thing while you're intoxicated?
You know, I don't think there's a specific regulation against that, but it would probably come under the FCC's good character regulation in regards to...
I don't think there is a rule.
Being able to hold licensing. You know what? Kirk is a good character, so.
I don't believe there's a rule for that, but I do believe it is encouraged.
Well, I only drink wines of good character. All right. Hey, let's bring in our guest. I'm so pleased to have a guy that we normally can't bring on the show because he just lives too darn far away in a place too remote. And although they ran an undersea cable, maybe it'll get better. And that is my friend Joey Cummings, who's the VP of South Seas Broadcasting. Hello, Joey.
Hey, guys. How's it happening?
I understand. It's good. I understand you're stateside. You're in the mainland right now, but normally you hang out in Pongo Pongo, American Samoa. Tell us a little bit about what you do in Samoa and what the heck you're doing here stateside now.
Yeah, I'm the VP and GM of South Seas Broadcasting. We have a couple of FMs and some television interest on the territory of American Samoa, the big island of Tutuila. And when I say big, I mean about 20 miles long and about 5 miles wide at the very widest spot. So it's a pretty insignificant dot out in the middle of the ocean. So small that if you look at it on a globe, the small blob of ink that they use to represent it is actually too large. I'm currently in the States to visit my new niece. I have a young one, and I wanted to come and count the fingers and toes. And I'm in Concord, California.
Oh, that's not too far from Petaluma, the Twit Network.
No, I did not. I'm here visiting Captain Kirk, too.
Yeah, I see. Well, no proper geek room would be complete without a Captain Kirk stand-up.
Yeah, never.
Yeah. Hey, so we're going to talk about a couple of topical topics, and then we're going to wind our way into talking about American Samoa and what's going on there in radio and some of the adventures, Joey, that you've had in doing that. Hey, let's kind of wrap up NAB. We did a live show from the NAB, from the Twit stage there last week. And I want to bring Tom and Chris Tarr to bear on that subject. Did you guys get a chance to review or watch the tort that we did from out there?
Unfortunately, no. I've been up to my earlobes in things going on. I just haven't had a chance.
Maybe you better tell us what transpired with your world while we were gone. Chris Tarr, did you get to get any feedback from NAB from your friends?
I did. I'd actually, I watched Twit also from NAB while you guys were out there doing the show. It looked great. But it's funny how, and I think you guys actually mentioned it, how all of a sudden, we had a couple of years there with the NAB radio show or the broadcast show where attendance was pretty down. And this past session looked like there was quite an uptick in vendors and people attending, which I think is great. And it sounds like it was all about 3D. In fact, somebody, I think it was on Twitter, had made a joke about how they were just going to throw an eye patch on because they were getting tired of getting stopped to be asked to look at things in 3D out on the show floor. So it sounds like that was a big thing. But the feedback I've gotten from the people who went, everybody said it was a fantastic show.
You know, this 3D is everywhere. In fact, I heard at the Truckers Convention next month, they're going to have 3D CB, and that's looking pretty scary. Try the beef tips, folks. He'll be here all week. Now, of course, in radio, we don't have 3D. We did have some advances in technology showing up in the radio hall. One of the vendors, Comrex, and you guys have had Tom Hartnett from Comrex on, they showed a product just totally out of the ballpark for Comrex, who's been an audio company. They showed a camera, an IP codec for video as well as audio that fits on the back of a professional TV camera. An ENG-style camera. So that was pretty cool. Harris, notably, showed a 20-kilowatt-capable FM and HD transmitter that fits in a single 19-inch equipment rack. That was pretty impressive to get that much power out of that little space.
Wow. Yeah. Did that fill the entire rack, or was that just how many rack spaces do you estimate that was?
It seems like Chris Tobin saw that, or maybe it was Charlie Wooten that saw that and said that there was still some space for more. In fact, oh, here, there's an ad for it in Radio World. So there you go, Harris. We're a great
Holy
radio
cow, podcast. That is fantastic.
And what are they saying here? It's called the Flexiva FM transmitter. And they're saying up to 20 kilowatts using the most compact design on the market today. You know, the hamsters have a really little cage to run in.
Or they're really little guys. They don't need much space.
It's FM plus HD, and it looks like here. Let me see if I can. Does this work at all? Yeah, I guess it kind of does.
Yeah, it
works.
Oh wait, there we go. So it's got the exciter in it, and then it's got two big honking power thing modules with air intakes on the front. So anyway, it's in Radio World, the latest one that just came in. Actually, I think there isn't the NAB edition of Radio World too. The last edition they had a picture of that transmitter. Who else came out with stuff? Well, of course, I worked in the Telos booth because that's who I work for. And we introduced a new console, a $6,000 IP audio console called the Radius that ships in a couple of months. And, one of the big hits of the show was this guy, Leif Clayson, a name that I hadn't heard of until about a year ago because I heard he was working with our sister company, Linear Acoustic. And Leif has this software. Oh, man, what's the name of the software that he puts out, that you can make your own FM processor. Oh, gosh, the chat room. Somebody keep an eye on the chat room, because I'm sure the chat room will have an idea of that. I guess I could go to the chat room and maybe find out. So Leif's processor in software, he's now adapted to be a processor in hardware because he's joined up with folks at Omnia. And one thing that he demonstrated on the show last week, which, by the way, if you want to see it, you can go to YouTube, go to the Twit channel on YouTube, and you can watch Tort episode number 78 from the NAB show. And Leif was on for a good 15 minutes or so, and he explained some technology called a declipper. Ah, from the chat room, it's the breakaway processor. There you go. Lake's been working on this breakaway processor. Very cool, very feature-rich, runs on a PC. But the features in Breakaway are in the Omnia 9, plus a bunch more features. And this declipper is just amazing. It's a declipper plus a process he calls undo. It de-hyper-compresses the audio so that now he can go process it in the way that he thinks is right. And hopefully the broadcaster thinks is right. Chris or Tom, do you guys know anything about this kind of technology, this declipping?
No. I mean, are you... Are you talking taking the actual song and deprocessing it, or are you processing the audio first, then taking it apart and processing it?
No, we're unprocessing the way the song was processed. And the thinking is here that you know, a lot of record producers want the music to be loud on the CD or for the AAC or MP3 cut that you buy from Amazon or iTunes. And so songs now are mastered pretty loud with real, by golly, nasty clipping in them. And I don't know what tools that song music producers and mastering guys have to use. It'd really be good to find this out. I've heard they have some pretty basic tools, like maybe some diodes, to do the clipping. But if you look at it on an oscilloscope, it just looks clipped and it doesn't sound so good. Well, okay, I know people can overprocess FM, and I know they do every day. But it's certainly possible for Omnia or Orban processors and other FM processors, AM ones too, to make audio look pretty clipped without sounding so clipped, because they have some really good ways of hiding the distortion that is the result of such clipping. So Leif, and in association with a guy from the Netherlands named Hans, who I met, but we didn't get to interview on the show last week, Hans has this extremely cool algorithm that declips clipped audio, and it replaces the clipping with what looks like real, by golly, waveforms that probably should have been there in the first place. And it's not perfect, but it sounds near perfect. It's just amazing what they can do. And after talking with some engineers at the NAB show, it's a great time for, you know, sharing ideas back and forth. Hans, who, by the way, is not in the audio business, he's actually in the medical imaging business. Hans got some more ideas on how to improve his algorithm. So he's going to come back with the next generation of the declipper. Leif will continue working on his undo process. And there you go. This will be in the Omnia 9 and the Omnia 11. Joey reminds me in our chat room that there's a YouTube of Leif. There's a YouTube video of Leif describing.
It's not Leif, but somebody has taken, and this is not the only guy that's attempting this magic, because definitely it's an issue, because if you look at these waveforms, they're just incredibly, look like they have crew cuts, and it's just unacceptable. It sounds just bloody harsh on the ears, and they can take them and they can fix them, and it's just such a shame. I mean, it's blatant too.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think this could be kind of a little dangerous, because, you know, after you declip and after you deprocess, you'll find out what some of these people really sound like. Boy.
Somebody said of Leif's breakaway processor, maybe it was the Omnia 9, they said, you know, that processor is so good, we can actually hear the explicit lyrics now.
I'm not worried about it, because, you know, I'll unclip it and then clip the crud out of it again when I put it back on the air. So it's all right. You know, I'll just clean it up and then smash it again.
Right. But I'm people may think I'm fooling myself or talking gibberish here. There's ways to do clipping and there's ways not to do clipping. And I got to say, you know, the folks who process audio professionally for broadcast, and that would include our friends at Orban and the folks at Vorsys and the folks at Omnia and the other companies around the world too, they know something about doing this. And I got to say, especially the top of the line guys, you know, the Orbans and the Frank Fotis of the world, and the guys that I know, Corny Gould, Greg Oganowski, who we've had on the show, and Leif Place, and these guys understand how to process audio so that it's good and loud and consistent and even sounds more exciting than the original cut, but they know how to hide the distortion. They've got some incredible techniques for doing clipping in a multi-band environment and then taking the distortion that occurs from various different audible bands and hiding it or getting rid of it or filtering it out in such ways that you can just have incredible loudness and clarity without it sounding really grungy. And
you know, go ahead. Remember the days of the Modulation Sciences clippers, you know, and how you could sit there and watch the pilot just get clipped as well as with the bass band and SEA trash, and how dirty those sounded. I mean, we had some comparisons where you could, it almost sounded like there was static in the audio, and it was just the result of all that clipping. And nowadays, you can do away with those bass band clippers just because the clippers in the audio processors have gotten so good that you can achieve that same loudness without any of the distortion and any of the noise of the bass band. It's fantastic.
And, I would wonder why in a lot of these studio recordings and such, why do they, coming from the studio, why does it need to be so clipped and loud? I just don't get it.
Well,
you think you'd want it to be pristine. I know some people look for either a signature or they're looking for something to make it stand out. One of the songs that comes to mind from the 70s was Go All the Way by the Raspberries, where, I mean, the VU meter didn't move.
That's a great example of a wall of sound.
Phil Spector? They were looking for an effect, but yeah. Geez. Yeah.
Well, there was a study that came out, I've referred to this before, it was probably 2 or 3 years ago now, where they took college-age students and they played clips of songs at various bit rates and various, distortion levels and things like that. And people actually preferred the sound of the low bit rate MP3. And I think that, people have grown up with audio that isn't pristine, that when they hear something that's pristine, they think there's something wrong with it. It sounds odd or kind of foreign to them. It's kind of that whole effect when, HD radio first came out and we weren't processing the HD version very well. And people almost found it a little disjointed when, the audio just opened right up. So I think that's probably part of it is people have come to, they've come to get used to that kind of loud, noisy kind of audio. And if they think they prefer it just because that's what they're used to.
I'll answer Tom's question. Tom, I've worked at a lot of country music stations. And so you take an artist like George Strait. If you listen to songs from the early 80s, like there's a song he did called The Fireman. Oh, they call me the fireman. That's my name. I run around all over town putting out old flames. Okay. If you listen to that song and then you listen to one of his much more recent songs, like from, the early 2000s, late 1990s, or even something more than that, like Oceanfront Property, the old song from the 80s sounds really dead by comparison to the processed newer version. Some of his older music I like, but it just kind of lays there in the headphones and it just doesn't sound all that exciting. So maybe I'm just too hyped up on the drug myself. Now I'm not saying that his songs, are well processed either, but they certainly are more processed. And I think there's pressure from record, from act producers to say, make sure we stand up and print really loud on the CD. Now, somebody in the chat room asked, well, why doesn't Leif make tools for record producers to use? He certainly could. He certainly could. And actually, Omnia for the last 8 years has had a box called the Omnia 6 CD, which doesn't have the FM clipper in it. It's slightly different software that does multiband AGC and multiband limiting, but it's look ahead limiting for the most part. And we've had a few record producers buy this box and use it to produce CDs. And the processing that it does is good and loud, and you can make it sound really sweet. And it's pretty compatible with FM radio processing. You wouldn't have to run it through a declipper. Honestly, it's not a market that we've gone after a whole lot. I would imagine that there are presets and settings in Orban processors that one could use, turn off the preemphasis, that one could use for making mastered music sound louder and better. Greg Oganowski is a master, for example, at bass processing. I've always liked his presets, and so I think the record producers would do very well to do that. Why they don't, I don't know. It's maybe not something that they know about that well.
Did someone else say that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think Chris was hitting on something that was pretty cogent, where some people are looking for ways to make it sound worse because that's what they're used to hearing. But there's a flip side to that as well. There are people that are looking for sneaky, hacky type ways to make things sound better that sound worse that don't have access to this de-clipping software. I think it was a Metallica release a year or two ago that came out, and it was phenomenally just over-modulated right off the CD. It, like I said before, it just had a crew cut. And somehow they looked at the same song on a release of Guitar Hero, the video game, the same song, but it was far less modulated. So they found a way to crack the disc, pull the audio, the instrumental audio off of that, and remove the sound effects because they found that the unprocessed or the lesser processed version from Guitar Hero was far more pleasant to the ear whenever listened to separately away from the sound effects of the video game. So there are people that are looking to make it sound better, as well as the flip side of people that prefer the sound of an MP3.
You know, Bob Orban has a great quote. He still to this day uses it, which is, radios have a volume knob, but they don't have a deep density knob. So you crank it up and you can make it really loud, but that's the problem. Is the reality of it is we can all adjust the volume. If the song's not loud enough, we can all turn it up. Unfortunately, we can't declip it. And, there's no knob on the radio to do that. So, but it's the same way. It's the same thing with top 40 stations that pitch their music. We're always trying to get that signature sound. You're always trying to get that, it goes one more than the next guy. And I think what happens is the consumers, they get used to that. And so when you give them something that's nice and clean and pristine, they go, there's something wrong with that. And you can tell that when people buy, CDs of artists, like, for example, that a top 40 station's playing in town and it's pitched 3%. You go and you buy the CD, you put it in the CD player, and you go, there's something wrong with this. It doesn't sound right. And so I think, there's a lot of people in this chain that are guilty in this situation. I think it's the record companies. I think radio stations. I think, there's a whole lot of people that have gone a long way to purposely destroy the, as I like to say, in radio, we're probably one of the only businesses on the planet that, takes very large steps to kind of destroy the product that we're given in the first place.
Well, and that's the problem. I mean, I can agree with you, but I have to disagree with you. If you want to, if you played songs with no processing at all for listening in the car when you're driving down the road, you'd be cranking that volume control up and down and up and down, depending, especially if it's a station that plays a mix of the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and today. There's such a wide variety. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, sure. No, I agree. And I think that, it's just like any other spice. A little bit would be great. Unfortunately, we've gone to putting a whole bunch of stuff on there. And believe me, I am probably more guilty than anybody in my market of that. I've got, two radio stations that are just screaming off the dial. I get it. It's a competitive, it started out where it was to protect the transmitter. Long ago, that's what the gain controllers were supposed to do. Then it was, okay, we're going to fix the ambient noise problem. Now it's just essentially, let's be as loud as we can and go one more than the next guy. And once we went from just kind of using processing as a little bit of a spice to that's the recipe, I think that's where things started to go south.
Chris, have
personally,
you ever had-
as far as pitching music goes, I still think that if you had four CD players in the studio, loaded them all, and fired them all at the same time, you could really say that nobody gives you more music.
I say put one on the left channel and then another one on the right channel, and then you could have two songs go on. Figure out which one you like better.
That's right. We play 120 minutes of music every hour. Chris, your spice analogy is pretty good. Have you ever had Thai food? Thai food is the food that kisses you on one cheek and slaps you on the other.
Put it this way, Kirk. I've heard a lot of Thai food on the radio.
I've heard a lot of Mamma Mia on the radio. Well, hey, Burke has queued up we're going to watch just a moment here of a clip. I want you to take a look at this clip. Is it with Leif Claesson? Burke, go ahead and play it, and I can narrate over it. I don't want to play very much of it. I just want to show folks where they can go. Here we go. Okay, this is Leif Claesson describing how his processor's working, and he goes into describing the detail about the declipper. And this was from, I believe this may have been from the processing days, processing freak days in the Netherlands. We'll get the link for that up on the show notes. And that's on, or if you want to just go to YouTube, don't do it now, continue watching the show. Go to YouTube and do a search for Omnia 9 or Leif Claesson. And you should be able to find this. I think it's four parts. And Leif was telling us on the show last week, he said, oh no, don't watch that terrible video. Apparently he had some technical problems at the beginning of the presentation, but they all got squared away by the end of it. So you can look at that, and Leif will have some more teaching later on. He's a really interesting guy. The son of Jamaican and Swedish parents, and now he's living in Thailand. So really interesting fellow.
This show is sponsored by Axia Audio. You know, these are the guys, the inventors of the LiveWire protocol, the LiveWire standard that's used by so many companies in broadcast, all these automation companies and satellite receiving companies. Even there's another audio console manufacturer that uses LiveWire. There's these time delay boxes. It's just one product after another after. There's soon to be a third-party codec that'll have LiveWire built into it. So LiveWire is such a standard because it's routable, it's low latency, it is so flexible, and it's based on the standards known as QoS, RTP, Real-Time Protocol, IGMP, Internet Group Management Protocol, and a number of other protocols that are just so standard. So it just plugs into stuff, and it's just not all that hard to do. Hey, even VLC, you know, the audio software called VLC, the latest version of VLC will play back LiveWire audio streams. So, hey, it's such a standard around the world. Well, hey, you've heard me talk about the consoles. You know, the Element console, there's over 2,000 of those now on the air around the world. Well, and you've heard me talk about the IQ console. This is available in all different sizes, starting at 8 faders and going up to 24 faders. Hey, we had a cool-looking one at the NAB show in Las Vegas last week. It was 20 faders with some phone control and some extra buttons. And this console was just absolutely gorgeous. For under $12,000. Good looking, beautiful console you'd be proud to have in any studio, and it's just plug and play. It's that IP, just plugs right in. Well, now Axia is introducing another new console. Right on the heels of the IQ, now shipping, Axia introduces the new Radius AOIP, Audio over IP console. If you thought $8,000 was too much for you, like for an IP, for a an IQ console, the new Radius console starts at just under $6,000. Now, it's not available with many options. Hey, it's got as many faders as you want, as long as it's eight. Okay, eight faders in the Radius console. If you want to check it out, go to the website. It's axiaaudio.com. And if you want to go ahead and go right to it, axiaaudio.com/radius. Although if you just go to the main website, axiaaudio.com, you'll find a link right on the front page to the Radius console. This is a really cool little console. Eight faders. Hey, it still does all these things like automatic mix minus. It still has four buses, you know, program bus 1, 2, 3, and then a telephone bus or a recording bus, however you want to use it. It still does different profile, so you can set it up for different different day parts or different jocks, whatever you need. It still even handles a remote studio. Yeah, a studio on the other side of the glass. So has all these features packed into it, but it's a smaller console with eight faders and fewer inputs and outputs than the IQ console. But it may be exactly what you need, and it's under $6,000 US. So check them both out. The Radius console, brand new and shipping in a couple of months, and the IQ console, now shipping. And, of course, the big stalwart available in huge sizes if you want. Check out the one in Paris at Energy, where they have this, like, I don't know, 40 faders, and it is the world's largest Element console that they use there for a real slam, jam, and dance show on the weekends. AxiaAudio.com. Hey, they're my employer, and I am so proud and happy to be employed by these folks. The tech is so cool. It goes in easily, and just wrap your head around it. You're really going to like it. Check it out on the web, AxiaAudio.com.
And we're back on This Week in Radio Tech, episode number 79, with Kirk Harnack, Tom Ray, and also with Chris Tarr. And our guest today is Joey Cummings, VP and General Manager of South Seas Broadcasting. Hey, Joey.
Hey, man.
Listen, we're going to have some stories from you right about now, talking about engineering challenges and running radio in general in American Samoa. And let me set the stage just a little bit. I was very privileged some years ago. Gee, this must have been in the mid-90s when a guy named Larry Fuss, who I had known for a while and been associated with at some radio stations, he approached me and said, hey, would you like to own a radio station in American Samoa? And I said, what? Where? He said, well, he says, I've been looking at this first-come, first-serve list. And this was a list the FCC used to put out of first-come, first-serve open licenses. And the first tenderable application to come along, that person, if it was a valid application, would get the license. Now, these were usually stations in places like West Undershirt, Arkansas, you know, places where hardly anybody lived. And these were stations that at one point were allocated to the FCC's table of allotments, the FM table of allotments. These were all FM stations, how they worked. And somebody had abandoned the idea, was no longer interested. So these were just open. They were allotted, but nobody had the license. So Larry found a couple in American Samoa, or he found this place called Pago Pago AS. Yeah. AS, where's that? AS, is that Arkansas? No, it wouldn't be Arkansas. Is that Alaska? No, that's AK.
No.
Alabama. No, there's no S in Alabama. So he had to open a book and do some looking, and this might have been even, you know, pre-real internet. And then he found, aha, it's American Samoa. Where is that? So he spun the globe and found out to get to American Samoa, you fly to Hawaii, and then you turn left. And you go about halfway to New Zealand. There's a little part of America just south of the equator. Consists of several islands, I guess four or five islands or so. And the main island is called Tutuila. And the capital city there is, turns out it's called Pago Pago, American Samoa. And there was a radio station license available there. And another one in a town on the other side of the island called Leone. And so back in that day, back then, before the Telecom Act of 96 was passed, the same company could not own both of these FM stations. So Larry applied for one and I applied for the other one. And we were granted both licenses eventually, and then I ended up selling my license and put the money in to, you know, do the other one. And so we ran the little radio station for a while, but we didn't have a good general manager. We needed somebody with skills, with game, with, you know, come down there and make the radio sound really great and sell some ads too and hire a staff and run everything. So we ran into Joey Cummings, who had worked with me in Mississippi radio. So now, to this point, Joey was not an engineer. But, you know, old Kirk Harnack can't get down to American Samoa just every day. So we're gonna bypass all of Jerry's troubles and tribulations on the air and go straight to the engineering stories. So let me bring you on in, Joey. Hi, I'm sorry. I just wanted to set it up so people kind of knew the background here.
Yeah, it's very far away, and it is most challenging because it is so far away and it is so small. Everything that you take for granted just doesn't work like you expect it to. Electricity, maybe 110 volts could be 120 volts. If you need to make a phone call, well, 10 cents a minute could be $5 a minute. If I wanted to have this experience with TWRT, then if I wanted to have the same amount of internet that I'm using right now, the bandwidth, I'd pay about $10,000 a month. That's U.S. dollars.
Gee, man. Yeah, I remember for the longest time there, we shared like one with 10 other people, with 9 other people. We had 1/10 of 512 kilobits per second.
We still do, Kirk.
We do? And it cost us, back then it cost us $500 a month. I think Larry said the cost went down.
$450. That's savings for you.
For 1/10 of half a meg.
Yeah, yeah, we average about 128, maybe 200 on a good day.
Oh, gee, money. It takes forever. You know, every day this affects you in ways like you want to get your Microsoft updates done.
Well, you know, no.
You start them at 6 p.m. when everybody goes home, the bandwidth goes up, and and then by the next morning you might have some updates ready to put in there. For example, our stations, I'm part owner of these stations, and Joey is too. We stream from the website. You can go to Joey, correct? Is it 93khj.tv? I'm sorry, .fm.
That's correct.
Okay, 93khj.fm. And if you go there, you can click a button and do some streaming. But, hey, don't everybody all at once. We send one stream from American Samoa to a server in Las Vegas. And from there, we can handle about, I don't know, 30 people or so. So, you know, the bandwidth is very precious
between American Samoa and the mainland. So I'm sorry, John, I interrupted. Go on with your stories.
No, that's a very handy bit of engineering and very typical of what it takes to solve a problem. If we want streaming, okay, we'll have streaming, but we can't stream to everybody, so we'll send it to Las Vegas. And that was some of your handiwork, Kirk. And there's just a ton of other examples of the things that we've done to get by, and some of the cheap equipment that we'll use to serve in the stead of more expensive gear and means. But more so than the solutions that you get to plan, it's the solutions that you have to come up with off the top of your head whenever there's something akin to an emergency or heavy weather or something like that. It's those kinds of things that really surprise me at the end of the day when I look back and I go, did I really just do that? And that's some of the things we were talking about before when we were talking before the show.
I've alerted Burke to the location where you have some photos stored, Joey, and he'll be bringing some of these up soon. American Samoa came in the news, about a year and a half ago with this horrible tsunami that we saw when it hit Japan not long ago, and there were lots of cameras in Japan to cover everything. Not so many cameras in American Samoa recording the events. Talk to us about that. What caused it and what happened, and how was our station really affected pretty significantly compared to, because of its location?
Yeah, we got rocked. I think we did get some footage. I got some footage as it happened. If you'll go to YouTube and Google my name and tsunami, it should be popped up. I think every network known to man stole my footage and and listed it as their own. But the radio station sits at sea level, basically, but we are on the second floor of a two-story building, a concrete building, and that made it very possible for us to stay above the water. But it was early in the morning, and just before our 7 o'clock news, we filled this earthquake. It lasted for a couple of minutes, and at that time, talks of tsunamis weren't really... that really wasn't something that came up a lot. So there wasn't a lot of protocol as far as drills. And while we did have EAS up, there really wasn't a good way for people to determine, okay, was this a tsunami warning level of event? Well, what do? They call the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Hawaii. And they were trying to get information from them, but it takes them a long time to process data from their buoys that are out at sea to detect rising and lowering seawaters. Eventually, we knew that something was going to happen because the waters were starting to recede. So we activated EAS. We didn't have any other official warning, but we decided to send a tsunami warning via EAS, and it was a pretty spooky feeling to push those buttons and choose that off the list of events, gotta say. But it wasn't a minute later, the entire harbor area of American Samoa and many other villages were inundated with 10, 20, maybe even 30 feet of water. It rocked the place pretty hard.
So I understand that actually American Samoa didn't get the brunt of this. It wasn't it Western Samoa, which is, well, now called the Independent Nation of Samoa, a different country 60 or so miles away. Didn't they get the worst of it?
Yeah, they did, only because they have significantly more landmass and more coastline. It came from the south. And while a lot of American Samoa, the inhabited region, does face south, most of the people in neighboring Western Samoa live on the northern side, and that means that you're sort of looking at outlying villages and backwoods, as you might call them back here in the States. And so they didn't have really as much warning or alert what was going on, and plus the topography. There was a lot in American Samoa. You hit land, and almost immediately you're going straight up a mountain. In Western Samoa, it just gradually goes uphill. So the like in Japan, the waters flowed for half a mile inland, I understand, in some places. So it was rocking. They were bigger, and the topography was such that they lost like 100 people. In American Samoa, I believe we lost 34.
So when the tsunami hit, when it came into the harbor and our the station, the office and studios where you are located at the is it the mouth? Not the mouth of the harbor. It's the end of the harbor. So that's
the
where
belly.
The belly of the harbor. And see, it seems like was the first thing that really got wiped out was our backup generator.
Absolutely. That's exactly what happened. We have a very large backup generator, or at least we did. It's the size of a small, like 20-foot container. And it was up on a foundation 3 or 4 feet above the ground, but the water was just, there's no way you could resist it. Because along with the water, it was pushing boats, it was pushing cars, it was pushing debris from the bottom of the harbor, years and years of just crap that was...
Ooh.
At the bottom, steel barrels and junk metal and that sort of thing. So as it approached the building, it picked up that generator. It's got to be tons. And it lifted it 40 or 50 feet back behind the building. It was seriously intense water.
So I take it this took the studio off the air pretty quickly.
Yeah, we had backup batteries. UPS's gave us about maybe 5-10 minutes, and we used that to just keep telling people to go uphill and tell them what was happening. We sent two EAS warnings. We sent an earthquake warning and then followed by a tsunami warning. And after that, it was just talking as much as we could, trying to get as much information as we could. But before long, it was just us. You know, it's really strange feeling. We were on the air. I had just set up this joke. The setup had lasted for 20 minutes. And I was ready to deliver the punchline whenever the shaking started. And so I was really caught off guard. But you know what? I was handling it. I was just delivering your standard earthquake information. Get in a doorway, under a desk. Don't let anything fall on you, that sort of thing. And I just felt very calm and serene. The water, you know, send the EAS warnings, calm and serene. The water's coming. We're still on the air, calm and serene. Then the batteries give out and we're dead, a dead stick. It was only until I lost the protection of my live microphone, I didn't feel any bad vibes whatsoever. There was a job to be done. But as soon as that mic went off, I was like, oh, man, what are we doing here? There was a... as you can imagine, a significant amount of consternation and panic.
I heard that there was a woman in an office on the first floor, kind of below the radio station, and the floodwaters came up and up and up and up. And am I right about this? Did she have a rather harrowing experience?
Yeah, she was a lady with child, about 8 months.
You mean she was pregnant?
Yeah, correct.
Oh my goodness! Okay, pregnant Samoan woman. Was she Samoan?
Yeah. Yeah,
probably,
that's right.
Probably kind of a big lady if she's Samoan, right?
She is not a size 2. No.
Okay. So anyway, water. You said the station's on the second floor. Water's coming in from the harbor from the tsunami. What did she do?
After the earthquake, it made her want to have to go to the bathroom. All of that shaking on a pregnant lady. So she did. She got up from her desk and she went to the bathroom. As she was coming out, the water pushed a truck through the wall and cremated her desk. Just boom, splintered everywhere. So she survived that. So here comes the water. She hops on a desk. Water's higher. She gets on top of a 4-drawer filing cabinet. Pretty soon she's knocking the suspended ceiling tiles out and looking for ducting or anything else inside of there to grab onto so she doesn't get swept away. And she's pretty much up to her neck in the water. And she feels things bumping against her and the baby. But she did hold on long enough for the water to go down. And she climbed her way over all the debris, got up the stairs. She was cut up a little bit on her legs, but she was fine. A month later, the baby was born. The baby was fine. And, it's those kind of stories. I mean, if you think that one is just harrowing, there are 1,000 more just like it for every single person that was around that water.
And not all the stories ended well, but at least that one ended pretty well. Hey, we're going to turn our attention to the transmitter sites because we have some pretty interesting transmitter sites in Samoa, and you brought some pictures. We're going to get to the pictures in just a second, but first I want to describe one thing about how the AC power gets to I guess what's kind of our main transmitter site at the moment on a mountain that's called Alava, right?
Yes,
Mount Alava. Go ahead.
It's a single span that goes down from the power plant, which is at sea level, and it's a single span that goes from sea level straight up about 1,600 feet, three wires for the three phases, and it's a pretty interesting angle. Maybe over a quarter of a mile, it goes from sea level to 1,600 feet. So that's a serious trip, a high-tension line.
Just about a 45-degree angle because it's 1,600 feet up, and it's a. I've looked at this on a topo map. It's not but 1,400 or 1,600 feet. There you see it. That picture there. That picture was taken from, from the wooden platform that's on top of a lava, and this is right next to where the power lines come up. You can't see the power lines here, but down at sea level, right up against the ocean, there's a road that hugs the ocean there, and a place called Satala, that's the main power generating plant for American Samoa, for the island of Tutuila. It's right down there, sandwiched, but nestled between the foot of the mountain and the beach. And there's that's a road correct. There, and there's Satala, the power generation station there. It's all diesel generators. So from from Satala, power goes, you know, in both directions, left and right, up and down the road from that power plant, and it goes up the mountain. And it goes straight up the mountain, which is really a 45-degree angle. And you said, Joey, a single span of three, you know, high-voltage conductors goes up to the top, and then there are transformers, and that's not a lava. That is a mountain that's across the harbor from a lava. That's called Matafao. Did I get that right? And that's the tallest point in American Samoa, that Matafao. And there's no electricity up there. There's no towers up there. It's really tough to get to. I think it's a rite of passage into manhood to climb that thing.
Definitely.
you get your tattoos, you climb Matafao, you're a man. So, these high voltage cables that go 45-degree angle for more than 1,600 feet, take 1,600 feet up, 1,600 feet this way, and figure what the hypotenuse is, and there you go. That's how long the wires are. And it's just amazing to see those things. If you're up in the mountain and look down and just see them just dive all the way down to the power plant, you really lose sight of them, and you can see the power plant down there. So these things, in a wind, like in a hurricane, which you're getting to, these things start swinging around. And, the power company has often cut the power preemptively. So these things, in case they hit each other, these
much
lines.
To our chagrin.
Yeah, they cut our power preemptively just to save themselves. So Joe, we talked about the tsunami a bit, and you want to let's look at these pictures in order, and this will kind of tell the story as you want to tell it. Maybe Burke can get the first picture up there, aside from the beautiful scenic shots we saw.
Well, generally, it's. The most troubling part of dealing with the plant in American Samoa is dealing with the weather, and that's because whenever it does decide to have some cantankerous weather, it has some seriously cantankerous weather, as in cyclones, which are the southern hemisphere version of hurricanes, and those have caused us more problems than anything else because, like Kirk, you're saying. The power company decides to turn off the power sometimes. Now, sometimes they will, sometimes they don't. And believe it or not, I can't decide which I like better because there have been times when they left it on that we've ended up with some seriously fried gear. Surge protection is no laughing matter. And that power company has been through every bit of surge protection gear we have more than once. And it's, here's this is a great example of here. This photograph that's showing is our other transmitter site, but it's the same story. The most important thing that that we can have whenever we're going up there to work on something after a weather event is a lot of times it's me going up there, or if it's something now where I'm on the mainland and I have to send somebody up there that's a non-engineer type. That I have a picture and that they have a picture. For instance, if whatever symptom that they describe, we're off the air and we hear this, and we can pretty much guess that it's a failed STL then I want to be able to send them a picture of the STL receiver on the mountain and say, this is where it is. This is where it is in the rack. And I prepared these little photographs with the little pointy hands, and everything is labeled. And there's a whole series of these photographs that allow me to be able to show them what's up there, where is it in the rack. And then that way, whenever I'm talking on the phone to somebody, they can know what I'm looking at if I'm up there, or if I'm talking somebody else through it. It's nice to have that reference.
Is also at Olatelli, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, it is.
All right. And I'll describe this briefly. Olatelli, you can drive to Olatelli almost all the time. It's got a road that goes right up it. And so, in fact, FEMA is putting in some emergency generation equipment for 93KHJ to keep us on the air when the power goes out. And it's Olatelli that they're going to use. Oh, Joey, I'll get back to that. Tell us about this picture real quick. What are we looking at?
Well, after our latest cyclone, after a night of fixing things that I didn't really want to have to fix but did anyway, we had a beautiful sunrise, and in comes the cruise ships. So it's business as usual. It doesn't take long to recover from a cyclone. People will always find a way to clean up what needs to be cleaned up, because if the white people are coming with money, we must make sure that we are ready to receive it.
In fact, this is the bay here. This is part of the bay. This is the east half of Pongo Bay. And what this is, of course, it's a blown out volcano caldera, and it's very deep. So it's a very safe place for ships to harbor in that part of the Pacific Ocean. So ships do come from quite a distance around to take safe harbor in this bay. It's very deep, and it comes into the island quite a ways, so they can get some safe harbor there. And that's Matafao, and there's some, you can see part of the village down there. What's the actual name of the village where the government buildings are, as we're looking at there, Joey?
Fangatongo is the seat of government for American Samoa, and that's the village depicted in that last photograph.
Fangatongo, okay. So, so we have these two mountains. Oh, yeah. What's this? What are we looking at? Top of the building?
Well, Cyclone Wilma came through in February, and it was a perfect lesson in if there's a job to be done, don't let it wait too long. This is our new STL mast, and we use it to obviously hold the STLs and a couple of backup bays in case everything goes wrong. We can always turn on some backup transmitters from the studio site, and we can cover with about 100 watts, we can cover the harbor area. And this is the new STL. Well, you see the STL transmit antenna at the base of it.
Yeah.
At the beginning of our last cyclone, that STL transmit antenna was not on that mast. It was on the other photo, which you'll see just a pile of junk and wreckage. About four in the morning, we hear this gigantic crash. We had been doing really well all night, stayed on the air, giving people updates on this pretty nasty cyclone that was bearing down on us. And we successfully stayed on the air, and we felt really good about it, knowing that we have all these power issues. And we hear the crash, we're off the air, and I'm knowing that it's this 11-year-old STL mast that I keep meaning to get up there and take all the antennas and stuff off of it and move everything instead of just some of everything over to the new mast. And there's the downed one. It fell down. It pretty much crushed our FM receive antenna, our NOAA radio receive antenna, and the STL transmit antenna was at the base of this thing. So what does that mean? Well, it means that it's 4 in the morning and you got to get back on the air. So I slipped a couple of wrenches in my pocket, up the ladder, across the roof, during a cyclone, about 50-mile-an-hour gust, very much stinging rain. So it took about 20 minutes to disengage that antenna from the down mast and move it over to the new mast. But it was a great lesson. If there's something that needs to be moved, go ahead and do it now. Do it while the sun is shining, rather than having to take shelter every 30 seconds when a new gust comes up and is trying to blow you off the roof.
That's a lesson you learned in Samoa. You do stuff while the sun shines. That old phrase, you know, that Grandpa said, make hay while the sun shines. That's true in Samoa. Because if you don't do it while the sun's shining, you're not going to be able to do it. If you ever seen the old movie, a black and white movie called Rain, about American Samoa.
It rains.
It rains a lot. In fact, so I was describing two transmitter sites, Olateli, which I guess in Samoan means telephone mountain. That's accessible. But the main transmitter site that, our stations are using now is on Mount Alava. And Alava, this would be a fantastic place to shoot a four-wheel drive SUV commercial. There's about 3.5 miles that you have to traverse across the ridge of a mountain line. And you go to the top of the ridge at this nice, you know, cutover behind Pongo Pongo, and then you're on some Forest Service land that they actually lease, and then it's, you know, 3.5 or 3.7 miles along this ridge, and on many parts of this ridge you're driving along in whatever four wheel drive vehicle you got, and 5 feet to your left or 5 feet to your right, it becomes 1,600 feet down.
That's it.
Am I right?
No. You pretty much got it. And you also hit the nail on the head when you say it would be a perfect opportunity to film a commercial for a four-wheel vehicle, which is exactly why I bought an ATV. That was the first order of business after the tsunami. So many people had their trucks taken that the usual people that I would bum a ride from, they just weren't available anymore. And if you ever rode a four-wheel vehicle, an ATV, as a young man, and thought that, oh, yeah, it'd be cool to do the things like you see in the commercials, this is that trail. It takes every bit of ATV driving or four-wheel drive truck skill that you can muster to handle all of it. It's got rocks. It's got inclines. It's got boulders. It's got riverbeds. Huge mud holes. It's everything that you need to make a auto mechanic happy, because you will be visiting.
Oh, I broke an axle on that thing coming down. I broke a Jeep Wrangler axle coming down that thing one time years ago. It's also got a hill that is so steep, and there's something about the mud that's so slick that if it has rained and your vehicle gets stuck and you get out of the vehicle and try to stand up, you cannot. You'll slide right down the mountain. That's how slick it is.
That's absolutely right. In fact, I think there was a visiting crew from maybe a visiting tower company that was up there to reconnoiter for an upcoming tower repair. And they got halfway up. It's not quite 45 degrees, but they got about halfway up this hill, and they started slipping and sliding. And there are walls that go about 6 or 8 feet on either side, and it's about two lanes wide. And they got the truck stuck sideways. They couldn't reverse. They couldn't go forward. They ended up having to get a backhoe up there to chain the axle and just pull it back into position so it could drive down.
Gosh. So at the main transmitter site, once you finally do get up there, by the way, you can't drive the transmitter site. You can drive to the bottom of a steel staircase, and then you're 77 steps up to the same level. I know how many there are. Up to the main level is the transmitter site.
Yes, there are 8 less than what he claimed.
Oh, really? Is it 69 steps?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, you've done it more than I have. Okay. Yeah. Maybe I got confused because it was so difficult. Hey, I think we may have one more picture from Burke to show us on a map. If you guys want to go to Google Earth or Google Maps, or you want to find Mount Alava, you may be able to get some good pictures from Google Maps on there. It's just an amazing place to try to build and run a radio station, and I'm delighted to have been asked to be part of it, and still am. I haven't been there in a few years, but I sure would be excited about going back to it. Okay, we're not going to have the picture, but there we are. Yeah, we're getting close to it.
Yeah, that's neighboring Western Samoa.
That's Western Samoa, so you want to go to your east about 45, 50 miles or so, and we'll see American Samoa. Didn't mean to leave Tom and Chris out of this. We've been talking so much here about this. I just happen to be pretty familiar with the situation because I've built the first, you know, transmitters that were at these locations. Tom, Ray, let me bring you in, and Chris too. You guys got any comments or questions for Joe?
No, it just sounds like some of the adventures I had. I used to take care of some stations down in St. Thomas, U.S. Virgin Islands.
Oh,
But yes, but very similar. You know, you come off the water, you go straight up. I can't tell you how many sets of brakes I've gone through on cars down there. Nothing like getting a brand new car at the rental place, coming down the mountain and having smoke pouring out of the front end of the car because, you know, you're trying not to go screaming through a traffic light at the bottom. Plus, you're driving an American car on the wrong side of the road. So, but no, you're right. With the power company and everything else, you just don't know what to expect, and it's always an adventure.
Yeah, indeed.
Mr. Tarr, you got any questions for Joe?
No, you're a bigger man than I. I don't know that I'd want to go through all that. That is just that's amazing. Now, it sounds to me like you know really a lot of what you're trying to do. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you know it really is kind of you obviously have to be very self-sufficient. But it sounds like you do a very good job of kind of just documenting everything and what everything does, and getting people familiar so that when you when you have to talk them through it. They know what you're talking about. And I guess, you know, we all kind of, you know, in engineering management, we all kind of go through that because we're not in our facilities all the time. So, you know, sometimes it's whoever's on the air has to kind of walk through emergency steps. And so, you know, what you're doing is it makes a lot of sense for a lot of people to do with the pictures that are labeled and things like that. But, wow, that is some, I just sat back and listened to your story. It's just fascinating.
This hour had... I'm sorry, go ahead, Joe. There's American Samoa, and you can see the harbor kind of in the middle, just to the right and up from the middle is the big American Samoa harbor that enters from the south of the shore of the island. And this is from Google Earth, and there you see a whole lot of beautiful tropical trees. As soon as we zoom out a little bit, we can maybe see where we are. I'm sure that's tough to work with. It's such a small island that, you know, you zoom in a little bit and bam, all of a sudden you're all the way zoomed in. You zoom in out a lot and all of a sudden it's gone from your screen. So it's a little tough to deal with. It's such a small physical area. The island's about, 4 or 5 miles wide and about 20 miles long. It's a great, beautiful place to drive around. And if you really want to take a vacation far from everything, first you fly to American Samoa. There's the airport, a part of the airport, and there's a harbor there next to the airport. That's a pretty famous airport. There was a big famous crash that happened there back in the, was that in the 70s, Joe?
76, I believe.
Yeah. They all died. It was bad. Or most died. But they've lengthened the runway, and you land on that runway after you've flown for 5.5 hours across the Pacific from Hawaii, or you take a puddle jumper from Apia, Western Samoa. I forget what I was just about to mention the last thing about that. It's an amazing. Oh yeah, if you want to get somewhere far away, there's the Manua Islands, which are about 60 miles to the east, and a little island called Ofu that has an airstrip. And a little resort there, and it's quite the place. You've been to Ofu, haven't you, Joe?
Oh, yeah. It's the place where you go where you might want to stay 2 days, but you might end up staying a week because the flight, not because you wanted to, but because you had to. It's one of those where the flight schedule is really more up to somebody's whims than any kind of organization.
Much like airplane air travel here in the States. Thank you very much.
Yeah, a little like that. And there's a little island at the end. Burke had that on. A little island at the end of American Samoa. Isn't that it, Joe? Yeah, that's Aunu'u.
Aunu'u. Yes. A nice little place to put a translator if we could ever get a little piece of land there. But all of the land in American Samoa is communally owned, except for a very, very small percentage of the land, which can be individually owned outright by an individual, which makes it, if you want a place to erect a tower or just to do some kind of project, then it's many, many, many layers of not only government bureaucracy, but of a cultural finessing in order to have access to this land and to use it. Because the land is sacred, but also the chief could use a new SUV.
It is amazing. When we got our land on Olatelli just to build a little transmitter site, and I mean 30 feet by 30 feet or so is what we got up there. And it's amazing how many people, families, lay claim to that land when you file the document saying that you'd like to build something there. And you think you're talking to the right person, but then, you know, a lot of other people step forward and say, oh, no, that's my grandfather's land. Oh, no, my grandmother used to plant taro on that land. And, yeah, pretty amazing. But it's also amazing how far an SUV will go in getting people to agree to let you build a transmitter site there.
Yeah, it's cultural.
Again, much like the States, actually.
Yeah,
but sure, you know, it's interesting. Joey said that most of the land there is owned communally. I've got a ham radio question for Joey. I know he's not a ham, and I know he. But I was reading this magazine called CQ, and supposedly there's some guy from Germany, not Germany, from Austria, that uncovered a secret plot in a congressional U.S. budget proposal to cut time that hams can be on the air because they're going to be apparently cutting the FCC. I have no idea what that has to do with my time on the air, but apparently there's some guy in American Samoa. It says he's recently subdivided a lot adjacent to his home into one-inch squares that he is selling to U.S. amateur radio operators. Holders of deeds to these plots are registered residents of American Samoa, and in addition to being eligible for amateur radio licenses in that territory, if they become citizens of the country, they would have to pay no taxes to the United States government. So I guess my two questions are, do you know anything about this? And then two, when I buy my one square inch, could you go over once in a while to make sure the neighbors aren't junking things up?
Yeah. Is the guy's name Tommy Greer?
No. Matter of fact, I can't pronounce the guy's name.
Has a lot of vowels, right?
Carl
Filianta? No, Aliamau Fa Alavale?
Oh, mercy. Well, this is a ham I haven't heard of. I'm familiar with several, but I'll have to look this guy up when I get back. It's a pretty small area. And indeed,
he's in Utumea.
Utumea. Oh, very much. Okay, so that's a very far-flung part of the island that doesn't sound like he gets to town too much, because eventually Uncle Sam is going to come knocking for their taxes.
Oh, gee. Guys, I wish we could go on and on. There's so many more tales to tell, and I appreciate you you sitting through me telling a couple of them and Joey telling a few, too. We're going to have to wrap up the show, and I want to run around and say thanks to everybody. Thanks very much, Tom Ray. Appreciate you being with us tonight from the Hudson Valley of New York.
Well, it's good to be back, Kirk.
And Chris Tarr, thank you for being with us as well from Muckwonago, Wisconsin.
Oh, great to be here, as always.
Well, hey, maybe next time we'll let you talk more. Sorry. And Joey, you're in California right now. You're on your way back to American Samoa anytime soon?
Well, it's on to Mississippi to see the parents and our stations in the Delta area of Mississippi next week. Then on to Idea Bank in Williamsburg, Virginia. Then back to Pongopongo, America, Samoa.
All righty. Thanks for being with us, and thanks for the comments in the chat room. Appreciate those. Burke, appreciate you doing the switching there, and thank you for watching. I sure appreciate you very much. We kind of took a little bit different tack this time. It wasn't quite so technical, but we did tell a couple of interesting stories. And if you ever get a chance to go to American Samoa, I know that Joey Cummings will welcome you with open arms at our radio stations there, the KKHJ and WVUV stations. By the way, one of the strange places in the world, we have the farthest W and the farthest south call letters, because we're south of the equator, the farthest south W call letter and the farthest west W call letter. I'm getting that wrong. Joey, what is it?
Well, WVUV was an old military call sign. It was an AM that the military put on. And as such, yeah, we do have the farthest west W, and we're the only W south of the equator.
I guess we're the only USK call letter south of the equator, too, because there's nothing else south of the equator.
In fact, that'd be right.
Yeah. So that in the same place, the same U.S. territory, we have WVUV. And KKHJ. All right, that's enough trivia. Hey, guys, we'll see you next week. Appreciate you joining us. You can check us out on the web at thisweekinradiotech.com or subscribe on iTunes. And very soon, if not this episode, awfully soon to be a member of the Twit family. So you'll see us on twit.tv. Appreciate you. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Axia Audio, makers of The Element, the new IQ now shipping, and the new Radius console. Check them out on the web at axiaaudio.com.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny Lopez Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.